This podcast is from Allegro Non Troppo on Joy Melbourne 94.9 radio station, Melbourne, Australia, and is produced for you by Adam, Peter and Robert. Hello and welcome to Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network. Allegro Non Troppo is produced at radio station 3JOY in Melbourne and is presented by Adam Stobbs and Peter Forte. On today's show we have Professor of Politics from La Trobe University, Dennis Altman. Dennis is well known as a bit of a media person in Melbourne. He appears on other radio stations as well as being an occasional on Allegro Non Troppo. Dennis is witty, intelligent, erudite, smart and reminds me very much of me. Welcome, Dennis Altman, back to Allegro Non Troppo.
Now, Adam, I would have to say that were I introducing you, I would probably not have said that you remind me a lot of me.
That's because I have better insight into people than you, Dennis Altman.
Well, I think we might leave the conversation. Given it's about 1 minute past 12 and we still have 59 minutes to go, I think we should leave this for something to come back to at the very end of the program and the listeners can guess.
I don't think it'll ever be resolved anyway, will it?
Dennis, not publicly, no.
Dennis, it's great to have you back on Allegro. And yes. I hope that this can be as something that we can look forward to from time to time. It's just good to have you here. You're such a great radio person, but you do have a wry sense of humour. And you know what, Peter? Dennis reminds me of one of my music teachers. He's got that glint in his eye that he's a bit cheeky.
Oh, yes.
Aren't you? You certainly were on Q&A a few weeks ago on the ABC.
Well, when I was allowed to get a word in, yes. But let me tell you, being on a panel with three egomaniacs and a slightly dippy young woman is something of a challenge.
Oh, right. Is that defamatory?
Well, there's only one egomaniac in this room anyway, so you're on safer ground.
So, Peter, you and I are safe?
Probably, I think so.
I think he was referring to you, Dennis. Oh, well, were you referring to yourself, Peter? It certainly can't be me. I don't have an egomaniac. Do you know, Dennis, it's funny the number of people have told me I've got an ego problem. I don't have any problems with my ego.
It's not a problem for you.
It's their
problem,
isn't it?
Absolutely.
Dennis Altman, since we saw you, there's been quite a lot has happened, and I've got several things I wanted to discuss, more as a conversation than an interrogation with you. But just prior to going to air, I was quite upset to hear that your mother died.
Yes, and I think we have to put this in context for people who are listening. Adam and I had dinner together, about 4 weeks ago? Perhaps 4 or 5 weeks ago. It was shortly before I went off for a trip to China. And while I was on my way back from China, my mother did die. And, of course, at dinner we had talked about our parents. And we talked, and there was a third person there. And I think quite a lot of the conversation, as I recall, was about the dilemma that happens to us all as we get older and our parents ultimately become our children.
Yes.
And a sort of new responsibility. And in the case of my mother, she had become very miserable, very frail, constant sort of physical problems, and she was more than ready to die. So in that sense, it's not a tragedy. It's a big event, but it's not a tragic event.
My parents are really very mobile and up and about, and they just come down to Melbourne and they're terrific and then there's no problem. They're starting to show some signs of elderly things. My father's got a bit of macular degeneration. My mother has some osteo problems, but they're still extremely alert and very active. And the other person that you were talking about who was at dinner with us, Tim, his parents are about the same as mine. But as parents get older, we as children get this responsibility and we worry about them a lot. Now, so yours has been discharged. How long ago did your father die, Dennis?
Oh, my father died a long time ago. My father died in the 70s. And my father had, in a way, an ideal death because he died with absolutely no warning. He, in fact, had been to the doctor that week who had told him he was in fine health and my parents were about to go on a trip to Europe. And that evening, my father sat up in bed, called for my mother, and when she came into the room, he was dead. He apparently had a massive stroke, and that was it. So it was a terrible blow for her. It was much different to this experience because there was no warning. Mm. So in a sense, great for him because he didn't have to go through any of the problems of aging, of the body deteriorating, of this constant round of becoming more and more dependent on other people.
So how old was he then?
He would have been in his... He was a lot older than my mother, and he would have been in his early 70s. Mm. I mean, my father was actually quite old when he had children. It was to do with the fact that he came to Australia as a refugee just before the war. He met my mother here, and by the time he had children, he was well into his 40s. So, as I say, it's been very interesting, and, you know, it's now long... I can stand back a bit, and I've seen two parents die in very different circumstances, one too soon and one too late. And, you know, none of us get our timing right.
How old was your mother?
My mother was 92.
Okay. How long had she been... is it non-ambulatory?
Well, it is essentially. She had a stroke about 2 and a bit years ago, following which she moved into a retirement home, which she didn't like, but which was not that unpleasant until about, I would say, 16 months ago, when her condition got worse. She had another fall. She needed either a walker or a wheelchair, and they moved her to a higher care part. You know how in nursing homes there are these various
levels.
Yes. Yeah. And she was deeply, deeply unhappy, and she hated it. She hated the fact that she was dependent.
Yes, as they are, especially in a nursing home.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, she would curse about the nursing home, and my sister and I would get angry with them, and we would write letters of protest, and, you know, there'd be these arguments. But the reality is that we don't have, as a country, we don't put enough resources into care for the aged.
Can I just stop you then, ask you a few questions about this, because this is a really important issue here. So she was in this home. Did the home, were they giving her good, adequate care?
Well, you know, it's terribly difficult to judge.
Okay.
And that's why I said I think you've got to go back to what resources are available. I think they were giving her the best care they could at a time when there is a shortage of people with the skills that are needed and when the sorts of support that are needed are so complicated because, you know, you can provide the basic nursing care, but what do you do for someone who is still mentally alert but physically very, very frail, who is deeply depressed by her condition, and who doesn't necessarily respond to some of the things that they tried to do? And part of the problem, which it'll be interesting to see how the recession affects this, is huge turnover of staff. So we would notice, you know, every few months there'd be a new social worker. And the social worker, and there was one who was there most of the time who I got to know a bit, but there was always somebody new. And, of course, by the time they got to know the people they were working with, they'd move on.
Yes.
Now, I don't know how you rectify that without putting really a lot more money into the system so that it becomes a job that people are willing to stick at.
Dennis Altman, you have there identified a huge financial problem and social problem that's going to unravel over the next few years as we have an ageing population here in Australia. You know, we've got a lot of people, and over the next 10, 15, 20 years, are going to have a lot of people who are going to need a lot of care. Who's going to do it and who's going to pay for it?
Indeed. And I think that it's, you know, part of the problem is that it takes a certain sort of personality and a lot of dedication to be willing to work with people who are old and frail.
I mean, and it's especially difficult when these people don't get paid very much to do it.
That's right. And I think that, you know, the way in which we pay people is absolutely absurd. I mean, we pay. It appears at times that the less important somebody's job is, the more they get paid. So if you're Sol Trujillo and you manage to totally fuck up one of the biggest corporations in the country, you get millions. If you're actually responsible for looking after two or three elderly, incontinent, non-mobile people, you get paid shit.
Yes.
Have I now broken the broadcasting code twice in that?
That's all right. We'll visit you in prison. Now, the thing about all of this is it's a terribly complicated. Perhaps what's the solution? Should we have maybe geriatric euthanasia centres that are mandatory at 85?
I'm not going to go on air and suggest that.
Because that'd be financially, that wouldn't cost much.
Unless you happen to be 84, of course.
Well, indeed. But also, Adam, it's there is no one age. There are people of 85.
Okay, so we do a test. Like a driver's license. You know how everybody over 80
had...
Hang on, Peter, let me finish. Everybody who drives at 80, I think, or 75, they have to have a test every year. And if they don't pass the test, they can't drive. So we could set euthanasia centres up with the same sort of means test assessment. Was that unreasonable?
Well, I think it's totally unreasonable. But I am reminded there's a novel by Sumner Locke Elliott. And people have largely forgotten Sumner Locke Elliott, who is actually, I think, one of Australia's more interesting novelists and, importantly, one of Australia's more interesting gay novelists, though he spent most of his time in the US. Sumner Locke Elliott wrote a novel once on that assumption. And I can't remember the title. Somebody might ring in or text in and tell us what it was called. I do remember very vividly it begins with a woman waiting to be taken to be euthanized against her will. And of course, the whole point about euthanasia is it has to be voluntary, and people have to have gone through sufficient internal processes to actively want it. So no, that is not the solution.
Euthanasia, by its very definition, is so difficult to access, and so it should be. We wouldn't want it to be something that's just readily available, although lots of science fiction and popular novels have actually used euthanasia set in the future as being something that's quite acceptable and okay. We did have Neil Francis and Rodney Syme from Dying with Dignity in last year when the private members bill was put before the state government for the Dying with Dignity, which was defeated quite heavily. But it wasn't defeated because the politicians were against the process and everything. It was defeated on lines to do with the parliamentary process and debate and how these bills should be put. The Dying with Dignity wasn't so much euthanasia. It was people who had acute, serious, chronic pain who were about to die being given access to medication to terminate their own lives. It was physician-assisted suicide. It wasn't euthanasia as such. And it was quite massively defeated.
Well, yes, and I think it is like... I mean, I can't imagine that at some point we won't move to a situation where that will become the norm. And, of course, Philip Nitschke, recently, in the last week, was detained in Britain.
Indeed he was, yes.
For, I think, extraordinarily courageous and important work, where he is actually going around talking to people about the possibility. But most people who, in the situation my mother's in, wouldn't actually qualify until the very end under those criteria, because we're now at a stage where modern medicine keeps people alive, but keeps people alive with a very miserable...
Low quality of life.
And a very undignified quality of life. I mean, it's a deep indignity that's hard often for us to really understand. For someone to be totally dependent on others. And if you don't have mobility and you need to call a nurse because you need to go to the bathroom, that is deeply depressing for people. And the answer to that, I think, is much more complicated. And presumably, one hopes, as we all get older, medical science will get better at improving the quality of life, not just keeping us going.
Do you think part of the problem is, though, that unless you're involved with someone like an elderly parent, then the elderly tend to get forgotten and pushed to one side and not really at the forefront of most people's minds?
Well, we actually do that, don't we, quite consciously, because in modern Western societies, we put people into retirement homes and nursing homes, yes, whereas I guess in more traditional societies, the elderly are living at home.
Because my partner works with elderly people, and it doesn't happen to all of them, but he's seen people drop off their elderly mum or dad at the nursing home and they never see them again. They don't come back.
I mean, one reads about that quite a lot. I mean, my sense, you know, it's interesting because over the last few years I've sort of talked a lot about my mother, as my sister even more, and Adam afterward came up at dinner when we were having dinner a few weeks ago. there are an awful lot of people out there who spend a lot of time and energy worrying about their parents and actually spending a lot of time. It becomes very difficult because at some point, the way we live today, it is impossible, really, I think, for most people to integrate an aged parent if that parent no longer has either physical or mental abilities that allow them to take part in day-to-day life.
And the way we've set our social services is they can actually be fairly independent and still live their lives independently. I know my mum and dad, the thing that they don't want to lose is exactly what you've just said, is their independence. They don't want to be dependent. They want to be able to live their lives by themselves under completely their own control. And look, I say good luck to them if they want to do that. But there comes a point, the ethical imperative here. What do we as a compassionate society and community, at what point do we allow people to go on to live with this suffering? Your mother was very depressed, very sick, very unhappy. What did she want?
Well, I have to be very careful because what she said she wanted, you don't know. I'm all in favour of giving people the option of terminating their lives. But I think when one says that, one has to be aware that in a certain mood...
That's right.
You might say, it's like, as we know, teenagers are very prone in fits of depression to say, I want to kill myself. It doesn't mean that we go out and say, oh, good, here are the tablets, go kill yourself. Obviously, there's got to be a whole very complex process before you give someone... the ability to do that. And there certainly are cases. And
Let me just illustrate this with the story, Dennis, of my ex-partner, my late partner, who died some years ago. He had a terminal illness, and in the last 2 years of his illness, while he was still relatively healthy, he said to me, I want you to promise that when I get to this stage, and he listed off a set of things, if I become this, 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 and this, that you won't let me suffer. I said, okay, what do you want me to do? And we went through and I said, no, I can't do this myself. I'll need help, but I'll try and see if I can solicit some help from medical people if this eventuates. When he got to that point, he was quite lucid and he remembered the things that he'd made me promise I would do, and he was terrified and went through with the greatest of anxiety that I was actually going to do what he asked. So that completely underscores the complexity of these issues.
Well, how do you know? I'm sure the three of us could sit in this studio and we could probably, without much difficulty, agree on the point at which we would want to die. But if we were at that point, I don't know that that's what we'd want.
We cling on to life when you come to the end, as miserable and as wretched as it might be, when the actual, on the deathbed. And the other thing that's quite interesting I've noticed, I'm an atheist, Dennis Altman, let me tell you, but the number of people that I know who've been close to death who've suddenly found religion, even some of the hardened atheists.
Yes, well, I have to say my mother didn't, and one of the things that she was most clear about was that she wanted nothing religious at the funeral. And this was very important. And so when my sister and I were planning the funeral, we were very conscious of this, and we decided, we had a friend come in as actually someone who's a professional broadcaster and is a friend, close friend of my sister's, as the MC, and I chose all the music. And it was actually quite difficult because the best classical music to play at funerals is, of course...
Requiem.
Well, it's religious. I mean, there's a vast amount of fabulous religious music. I did actually cheat because right at the end I played a short excerpt from a Beethoven cantata that probably had the word God in it, but it was sufficiently obfuscated in the German that I don't think anyone heard it.
Unless they were German. But I mean, if somebody does, at the end of their life, if somebody does suddenly find religion, so what? I mean, if it gives them some comfort.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I think people do, but, I mean, my mother, this was not an issue.
I'm quite surprised by both of you. If that happened to me, I would go to my grave feeling I was the biggest hypocrite on the face of the earth.
And I'd be,
oh, No.
Well, in this case, Adam...
It's not okay.
Okay, so in your case, we are going to have to write in a provision, a sort of, you know, I don't know.
Even if I pretend I'm a Christian, I'm not.
Even if you pretend a Christian, we're going to have garlic and crosses outside the house. Well, I guess garlic and crosses don't really work against priests, do they? I'm not sure what you use to keep priests away, but, you know, there are methods.
That's quite an interesting process. Dennis, how did you cope with all of this? How did you feel? Can you take us through your emotional journey, if it's not too personal?
I'm not sure that I can. I think that there's a mixture of relief because it was very clear. My mother had a terrible last couple of years and she was more than willing to die. That wasn't in doubt. So there is some relief. There's a sense, well, at least thank goodness it's over. But I think what happens that I find really interesting, having now lost both my parents, and suddenly you think, my God, I'm a bit too old for this, but I'm an orphan. There's a sense in which you miss your parents because I don't know if either of you are Freudians, and I am a bit of a Freudian, and I think that your parents are your superego. And when your parents are gone, I mean, in your head, you tend to think, oh, what would my mother think about my doing this?
Yes.
And suddenly your mother isn't there. And it has come up several times. I mean, I'm quite surprised.
You still do it, though. You still continue to do it.
Oh, yes, absolutely. We all do, I'm sure. Yeah. And I have this sort of instinctive feeling, oh, I have to explain this to her, but of course I don't. I think it's very... A friend of mine whose mother died, under not totally different circumstances, told me that he just felt very discombobulated for months. One of the things that happened to me was I just forgot a lot of things. Things that had been happening in the few weeks before and that I had sort of committed to. You don't know how lucky you are that I showed up today, by the way, because I have actually forgotten several things. Although they were carefully written in my diary, I just forgot them.
Oops. So you forgot to check your diary.
Well, or I would read my diary. You know how you could look at
yes,
something?
Yes, and it just goes straight through.
Go absolutely straight
Tell me
through.
About it. Dennis, we're similar age, you and I, and Peter, and it does happen.
Yes, but this doesn't happen to me. I'm very good at that stuff, and this clearly was, you know, this is a more specific relationship to the way in which the death of a parent is such an overwhelming event that I think everything else, your mind doesn't have room for lots of other things.
Yeah.
So it's not like the normal stuff. Of course, we all forget things. And, you know, we don't need Freud to tell us we forget things we don't particularly want to remember. So if I said I'd missed a dental appointment, so what? You know, I would not be the first person whose memories served them to miss a dental appointment.
Indeed. Were you expecting this to happen?
Oh, yes.
You were.
Look, one of the problems is my sister and I travel a lot, and for the last 5 years, there has always been this fear that one of us would be out of the country and this would happen. Indeed, that did. That is what happened. And I couldn't have physically got back to Sydney in time to see my mother conscious. I could have got back to Sydney in time to see her physically alive, but by that stage she was on very heavy morphine and she didn't know anybody or didn't know what was going on. So I don't feel any great sense of sorrow at that. It would have been better, obviously, for the family. It would have been easier for me because it's not a situation which you particularly want to get on aeroplanes.
No.
But we always knew that was likely.
So you felt as though you'd actually said your goodbyes some time ago?
The last time I saw my mother, it's a few weeks ago, yes. I think in retrospect, probably. And I would have hated... I've never understood... You know, this happens in movies, those scenes where people sit around the deathbed and say goodbye. I can't imagine doing that.
And, yes, it's quite awful, isn't it?
I think also, when you're young, you go through... a lot of us, I think, believe that you're going to live forever. But there are certain things that can happen in your life that cause you to look at your own mortality, like the death of a parent or if you're in a situation where you're close to death. Did you question your own mortality?
Oh, look, Adam and I were talking about this as we were walking into the studio, Peter. I think that for those of us who went through a lot of AIDS deaths in the early 90s, when there was those few years in which a lot of the people who were first infected died, because this was before there were effective antiretroviral drugs and the death rate in a small community in Australia was very high. I think that was, you know, in a sense, we were hardened. That was our equivalent to what a previous generation went through in World War II. So that I guess I always felt I was extraordinarily lucky. It was a fluke that I wasn't one of them.
We're going to break, and we're going to, when we come back after our music track, Dennis Altman, we might actually talk about that, because that's a really significant point, pivotal point in the development of Australian awareness of HIV AIDS and the gay and lesbian community, those dying years between 1985 and 1998 were really a huge impact on a lot of us. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network. Allegro Non Troppo would like to thank the Community Broadcasting Foundation for ongoing support of Allegro Non Troppo.
Allegro Non Troppo is distributed nationally via satellite on the Community Radio Network.
Our special guest once again on Allegro Non Troppo, and it's a great pleasure to welcome back to Allegro Non Troppo, is Professor Dennis Altman, who is the Professor of Politics from La Trobe University. First half hour of the show today, Dennis was telling us about the unfortunate situation of the death of his mother. We drew that out into quite an interesting conversation about how death has impacted on our communities and on our personal lives, and how it plays out in so many different areas. But we're going to just chat a little bit now about world politics. Dennis, this is your area of expertise. We wanted to chat a little bit about homosexuals and transsexual people in the worldwide political arena and how relevant it is. And are there, apart from, we wanted to talk about the, is it the President of Iceland?
No, the Prime Minister of Iceland.
Prime Minister.
Who is openly lesbian and who was elected a couple of weeks ago. Iceland, of course, is a country that's basically in receivership. It suffered hugely from the financial crisis. One gets the feeling that the entire population of Iceland, which is after all about equivalent to a couple of Melbourne municipalities, had been out there buying US subprime mortgages. And when the thing crashed, Iceland basically went from being one of the world's richest countries to being one of the world's greatest debtors. And one might be cynical and say, just as we in Australia had our first women premiers to clean up the mess the boys had left, they've gone one step further in Iceland. They have a woman who's an open lesbian doing the same thing.
Joanna Sigurdóttir, I think her name is. Something.
Well,
like
that. My Icelandic pronunciation is lacking, Adam, so I will go with that.
I think I'm pretty close. I'm just reading it on the web. She's been in the news quite a lot, actually, and it's. She was appointed the Prime Minister before the election, but now she's been re-elected. Now, this sort of shows that the world's moving a little bit more to acceptance of gay and lesbian people.
At least the Icelandics are.
And other countries are. New Zealand's had a transsexual member of parliament, Dennis, isn't that right? Georgina Bayer.
They did. And we, of course, have had a number of openly gay and lesbian members of parliament. Both Paris and Berlin have openly gay mayors. The US has a number of openly gay members of Congress. And Barney Frank, who was, I think, the first open congressman. In fact, I think he was outed because of scandals around page boys. Probably appropriate. Barney Frank has become a very significant player in the financial management of the US economy. And interestingly, at the moment, those people who like me look at the New York Times online will know there is a serious debate going on about whether President Obama might name an openly gay or more likely lesbian candidate for the next vacancy on the US Supreme Court. We, of course, in the person of Michael Kirby, again, are way ahead of the US.
It'd be quite a revolution, I think, in how society's played out in the US if they do that, because the US is one of those countries of extremes when it comes to social climate, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it would be seen as very provocative by the religious right, and it would be seen by the gay and lesbian movement as very important, and is making up for what they see as a great failure of Obama, namely the fact that he has been unwilling to support and endorse gay marriage.
Isn't there a difference, though? I mean, wasn't Michael Kirby, didn't he come out after he acquired his position?
He did.
Whereas in America, they're talking about somebody taking power.
I think that's right. This is different. And, of course, we've got to always be careful. So when we talk about the first lesbian prime minister in Iceland, I think the one thing we can probably say safely is she is not the first lesbian prime minister in history. She's the first acknowledged lesbian prime minister.
And the important thing is, there's a difference. People who come out before they're elected or nominated or rise to power and people who come out after. Just looking here in Australia, the number of people who were quite famous during the 80s but didn't say a word, but now that it's a lot easier for gay and lesbian people to exist without persecution or without any let or hindrance in Australia, a lot of them have now come out. A lot of entertainers and ex-sports people and whatever coming out. It's a different climate. Yet I don't think the struggle is particularly any less in a lot of ways. You know, for young people coming out today, they don't have the same social pressures that you and I had, Dennis and Peter. But they do have an equally challenging set of other things they have to face in their lives.
I think it depends a lot on the family and community environment. There's a huge difference between a middle-class kid living in the suburbs of Melbourne and Sydney and someone living in rural Australia, someone living in certain ethnic communities, someone living in families that are deeply religious, whether Christian or Islamic. I mean, in all those cases, yes, they're going to have the same sorts of issues. But you know, I think there is a huge shift, and to me, the way in which is it Matt Mutchler, the diver?
Matthew Mitchum.
Sorry, so who is Matt Mutchler?
Don't know.
Ah, a fantasy has come.
Oh no, I think you've been watching some of those other videos, perhaps.
Well, maybe he has a career we don't know about. But anyway, the reaction to Matthew and the way in which, I think very cynically, Nicola Roxon has now made him yet another ambassador for men's health, does suggest there are some real changes going on. And yes, it is tough, but it's less tough, I think, really far less tough than it was 20 or 30 years
ago.
And
also with Matthew Mitchum, what I admired about him as well was that he made, not only did he make no secret of being gay, he said, for instance, I want to be known as a good diver, not a gay diver. So I thought it just came naturally to him. He didn't feel the need to hide anything.
You know, there's a process here, and the process is this. What has happened is you have the people who were around in the 80s and the 90s who were quite closeted have come out. Politicians, performers, singers, people well known. Their coming out has given confidence to people who are up and coming before they get famous, like Matthew Mitchum, to come out. Now that process, the next level is we'll get social acceptance. All changes to legislation and everything don't change social attitudes immediately, but they help. But people like Matthew Mitchum, Anthony Clear, pop stars and people who are in popular culture, they relate much closer to younger generations than the politicians do. And they're coming out and making it saying with it's good to be gay, it's okay to be gay, is far more relevant as a social lever to making it easier for people to come out than politicians. But those politicians and other people that did come out probably started the process. What do you think, Dennis Altman?
Well, I think it's a bit odd to go back to the 80s. I mean, people started coming out a lot earlier than that. And I think, yeah, basically, you're probably right. I think you're certainly right that laws don't change social attitudes, but legal changes are very important, even though they largely reflect social attitudes. I would say, and I mean, we've had this discussion before, and I know you agree with me, Adam, that we've still got the overwhelming problem of religion.
Yes.
That the only institutional barriers left to acceptance of sexual diversity are a group of nasty, frustrated, repressed old men who run pretty well every organised religion around.
So does that mean then that in the future when the younger ones grow up that things are more likely to change?
You mean the younger clergy? No, I don't think there's any evidence of that at all. Because the major church, the major religious institutions, If you think of the Catholic Church, you've had now two successive conservative popes, which means that they are quite consciously bringing in people equally conservative into the next layers of authority. I mean, the Catholic Church has been steadily moving to a more conservative position over the last 30 years, in the same way we're seeing a revival of fundamentalism in Islam. So while there are lots of young Catholics and young Islamists and young Muslims, young Hindus, young Jews who don't share those values, there's no indication they're going to have much any more say in the church. I suppose the one exception is among some of the American Protestant denominations, where it seems that the sort of appeal of the religious right has peaked. And you are getting more questioning going on. You are getting people in some of those fundamentalist US churches saying, you know, what is so terrible about gay marriage? It really isn't equivalent to global poverty and climate change. And maybe we should be concentrating on those rather than getting all indignant about...
Do you think that younger people grow away from the doctrines of the church, that they're more likely to leave the church? I mean, isn't there that risk for the church that their members are going to be reduced because of the right-wing opinions?
Look, it doesn't seem to be so, actually, does it, really? Okay, numbers are declining, but not in massive numbers.
And they're not declining globally. I mean, they are declining in most Western countries, probably including Australia, although even here I'm not sure about that. Because, you know, it depends. What happened in Australia is you had this very large number of Australians would tick the census form that they were religious. And, you know, they'd have a denomination, most commonly Anglican and secondly Catholic. But they were totally uninterested. You know, the church in Australia was where you were baptised, married
and buried.
Exactly, and that was it. What we're now getting is probably fewer people doing that, but a growing number of people who take religion very seriously. We're also, after all, getting a growth of religious schools. We're getting massive funding of religious schools, which I think is a very, very bad public policy. And in many parts of the world, religious evangelicism, both Christian and Islamic, is remarkably successful.
Have you been to the US lately? Have they still got that whole channel for televangelists?
I'm sure they have many channels.
Because when I go to the US, I spend, you know, I go to sightseeing, I spend most of my time locked in the room watching the cable TV with a televangelist. It's so entertaining.
Well, Adam, I can only say that given the choices available, this suggests you're even more sexually perverse than I'd expected.
I've seen some of the most remarkable stuff. And that's what surprises me when I was saying that the US is a country of extremes.
Oh, it is. Absolutely.
You're seeing the religious claptrap that they put, that the televangelists come out with. You know, there was a show on TV in the US called 2020. Oh, I think it's still on. A couple of years ago, they did this remarkable thing where they got three couples. They got a man and a woman, two men and two women, right? They got these three couples to sit on a park bench and have a pash. They had a bit of a pash on, okay. The straight couple, nobody noticed. This is in a nutshell. It was a bit more complicated than that. The two lesbians, people came up to congratulate them and tell them, you know, it's great to see you out. Two gay men do it, and they called the police. The number of calls they got to 911, and the police came along and moved them on. So that tells you straight away what it's like for gay men around the world. Women, people seem to be okay with women.
Very careful about that, Adam. I mean, not around the world. I wouldn't like to be one of those two women on a park bench in Kabul.
I was going to say that. Or in Iran. It'd be shocking. So, I've lost my thread here.
While you're getting your thread back again, can I just inject a little question here, not related to what we were just talking about? I've heard reports that England or the UK is close to bankruptcy. Is that over-dramatising it, do you think? Or do you think it's really that serious?
I'm going to pass on that because I don't actually really know what that would mean, to be honest.
I think we're all bankrupt, aren't we? Isn't the world in this huge, incredible debt cycle? So it's quite an odd situation. I sort of understand it, yet I sort of don't. Is there anything less in the world than there was a year ago? Have we got any less? Is the material wealth of the world, the actual physical material wealth of what we have in the world, is there any less? No. there isn't. No, so what's changed? It's a psychological
impact. No, it's not just psychological. I mean, the impact on people. I mean, losing their jobs, their houses.
But why is this happening?
But it's a really interesting question, isn't it? Because, yes, both of those things are obviously true, but in a sense...
It's the distribution.
It's the distribution and it's the flow, isn't it? I mean, the whole of our sort of economy depended upon money flowing very easily, people being able to borrow, people being in debt, in a sense not worrying about being in debt because you could always borrow more, and an awful lot of businesses floated on that assumption. And once you suddenly couldn't borrow more... a lot of businesses collapse, so you get what Peter's talking about, you get unemployment. Of course, if you get unemployment, you get reduced demand so that more businesses go out of work. But at the bottom line, I think, Adam, you're absolutely right, that the world still has the resources. Same. And indeed, one could argue, and I think I probably would argue, as we were grossly over-consuming resources in a way that was deeply, deeply irresponsible for the future of the world, properly managed, the recession could actually be... a very good way of refiguring how we relate to global resources.
It's opportunity, isn't it? Out of all disasters, there comes an opportunity to rebuild, restructure and make things better. I mean, one awful situation that happened here in Victoria is possibly an opportunity for change that'll make people safer. I'm thinking about the Victorian bushfires. The thing that's happened there is this great opportunity has come around in the rebuilding process to make everything so much more sustainable, to make things a lot safer so that we don't have this situation once again. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo here on Joy 94.9 across Australia and the Community Radio Network.
Dance of the Rose Maidens from the Gainer Suite by Aram Khachaturian.
I love Russian music. And I have to say, Khachaturian's one of my favourites. He has such lovely rhythmic music, such a stonking beat. Somebody said to me, this is quite gross actually, somebody said to me, if you were to get a piece of music that you wanted to make love by, what would you choose?
Probably choose a sabre dance, wouldn't you?
No, 76 trombones. Da-da-da-da-dun-dun-da-da-da-da. You think of the rhythm.
You know what's going on in my head? Because I happened to watch a wonderful, but now 10 years old film last night, Happiness. I don't know if you've seen Happiness.
No.
Extraordinary. No. Very bleak, dark American film.
That's the one spelt with a Y, isn't it? Is it? Happiness?
No, I'm not sure. It may well be.
Is it a film noir?
Well, it's a comedy noir in a sense, and okay. It's set in New Jersey, and it is quite extraordinary. I highly recommend it. But there, the music for love which I thought was overused a bit, was the very famous trio from Cosi, was also, and those, this is good, I'm now talking to the film buffs out there. My memory is that was also used in Sunday Bloody Sunday. And again, people can ring up and text and complain if I'm wrong. But it's interesting how that particular trio, which must be one of, you know, is one of the all-time great moments in a Mozart opera, clearly has resonance for a lot of filmmakers as the music you make love to.
Okay, let's borrow a theme from another movie then, since we're doing this, to round up our conversation. Have you seen The Butterfly Effect?
I haven't.
Okay, this is a guy who's able to vacillate between different points of consciousness during his life, so he can actually time travel back in time and reoccupy his body when he was a child as an adult. It's 2030, Dennis Altman. We're living in 2030. Can you tell us what the world is like? Give us a future history of what the world's like from 2030.
Oh, in 2030.
Yeah, you've got 3 minutes. And that was Dennis Altman giving us...
around here you get no time to think whatsoever. Look, I can either give you a very bleak forecast, which is that the governments of the world do nothing about climate change, so by 2030, large parts of the world as we now know them are covered by water. Most people are living in very dense urban settlements, rather like, you know, housing those blocks of flats in the Collingwood, but going on mile after mile after mile, rather like a new city in China.
This is 20 years' time.
That's my bleak picture.
Okay.
The less bleak picture is that there will have been some genuine attempt to deal with climate change. There will have been shifts in the way we live. Motor cars will be regarded as something you use occasionally rather than regularly. People will be working primarily from home. Urban growth will have declined, and there will be a real increase in middle-sized and smaller cities. And there will be, in order to make any of that work, very severe population
reduction. Yes, that has to happen.
And what we used to, is still attacked by a lot of people as the one-child policy in China, will actually become the global norm. And people will remember Peter Costello's plea to have three kids as the sort of silly thing that Peter Costello will be remembered for.
Goodness, well... yes, three kids, people having three kids. We'll save that for another conversation. So while I've got you on air and I've got your head on the block, can we have you back later in the year, Dennis Altman?
You can, but I don't have a diary with me, so you can't pin me down to a date.
As ever, it's been terrific to have you sharing Allegro. A little bit light-hearted, but also very insightful. Thank you, Dennis Altman. We look forward to seeing you later in the year. Peter, we'll see you in a few weeks' time. You're off to Europe, leaving me by myself.
I am indeed, yes.
Okay, I'll be back with Allegro next week, everyone. Bye.